Okay, let's get started. Quick announcement, I have posted, there's about four graders for this class. They have office hours. I posted the details on the class website as well as on the discussion board. There is no homework as of yet, but I'm planning to do one soon, either this week or post it early next week. I need to cover some material before that. So, last class I talked about process context switching, and I got the feeling that it was a little too bizarre. So, we're going to try it again. What we are trying to do is as follows. We are currently executing process 1 on the only CPU we have. So I'm assuming there is only one CPU. There's a program counter pointing here. And this process has an address space that goes from A to B, and this is from C to D. And maybe it's like A, B, C, D, and this is 0, this is some large number n. So I have a memory address space in which process P1 is located between the memory addresses A and B, and process P2 is here. Okay? Now the thing to note is that regardless of what we colloquially say that all the smarts of a computer is in the CPU, the CPU is not at all smart. What does the CPU do is it just executes instructions. These instructions that the CPU executes are largely arithmetic instructions. Add, subtract, shift, multiply, XOR, test whether it's 0, greater than, less than. So it's just doing a bunch of arithmetic. That's all it does. All this wonderful stuff that happens with computers is built out of simple arithmetic instructions that can be executed on a CPU that is not very smart at all. The smartness is in the program. These combinations of things you have to do makes, in the end result, a computer that appears to be very smart because it can logically do certain things. So that's not the focus of what I'm trying to talk about now. What I'm trying to talk about is that a CPU, when it's executing a program, it is hopping through one instruction after another that is stored in that memory space. And of course it does looping and if-then-elses, but we're going to ignore that for the time being. So as long as the CPU is executing this process, P1, it also does input-output, let's ignore that. As long as this CPU is executing process P1, it will continue to execute process P1. Let's say P1 for a particular reason is a program that has an infinite loop purposely because it runs forever, kind of like a browser. If you keep it running, it will run forever. Okay, so it's just running forever. So in that case, it will keep on doing these instructions maybe over and over again. It's not going to do anything else, which is not what we want as somebody who's trying to implement an operating system. I want this CPU to execute P1 and P2 almost at the same time, which is not possible. So I'm going to switch it around in such a way that it'll appear to be executing both, and these switches will not be visible to P1 or to P2. That's my goal. And then I'll say, well, I can have 100 of these and switch them around. So how do we switch processes? Okay? So we need to write some code. There has to be a program that switches processes. However, that program is not part of this program. This is a program written by some application designer, writer, coder, whatever. So they're not putting in stuff here saying, oh, give you can ignore me and go to process P2. So somewhere, some code has to be there which switches things without the visibility. So it's invisible code somewhere, because only code makes the CPU do things. Does that make sense? And then we'll have to look at what is this code. Any questions so far? So we take a dumb thing, which is a CPU, which just fetches and executes opcodes from a position in memory, and that position is pointed to by the program counter. That's all it does. So we throw in something called a timer interrupt. So the CPU has a clock which is running its instruction processing, one instruction per clock cycle. I'm not talking about that clock. In addition to the clock, there is a timer, which is a much more coarse-grained clock. And that ticks at, depends, it ticks around anywhere from 10 to 50 milliseconds, so it will be ticking at the rate of 100 times a second, or 50 times a second, or 20 times a second, preset according to some formula in the operating system. So we're not really bothered about how quickly it is ticking, but on every tick, there will be an interrupt sent to the CPU, and that's an electrical signal. We can think of this timer as an off-board chip. Actually built into the CPU, but let's say it's slightly off-board chip that is sending electrical signals every, let's say, 100 milliseconds. So 10 times a second, it's sending a signal to the CPU. So whenever this interrupt happens from the clock, so we've already talked about how an interrupt handler works. Process one is between A and B. And the interrupt happens at this point, that is, the program counter is here when the interrupt happens. When the interrupt happens, there is a little hardware control in the CPU which says push PC, push PES, of a different way of drawing this. Okay, a little bit of scribbling here, and maybe the addresses are not quite correct. We have an interrupt vector tied to the timer interrupt. This piece of code doesn't exist anywhere. This is hardwired into the CPU. That if you get an interrupt, you will blindly, before executing anything, you will take the program counter and push it onto the stack. Push PC means push it onto the stack. And what does this statement mean? Push PC on this, put PC on the stack. How do you interpret that? PC is a register containing some bits. Yeah. You save that those bits into memory. Where in memory? The stack of the process. You save it on the stack of the process. How does the CPU know where is the stack of the process?
The PCB has the stack pointers.
CPU is too dumb to know anything about PCBs. That's an operating system construct. It doesn't know anything about PCBs. Yes, PCB has a stack pointer, but that's like buried somewhere in memory. The PC has another register, which we are not talking about here, but it exists and is very important. Want to guess what this register is called? The stack pointer. There is a stack pointer. So, moving on to the next slide, let's say, the CPU has program counter, program status, and stack pointer. The stack pointer has to be pointing to somewhere between A and B, where we assume there is a stack, and this is set up by the operating system before even the process started up. So that part I'm going to assume happens somehow. So the stack pointer has an address which is pointing to a point in that program which is being run by a process where the stack is. So push PC means let's say the value of PC is X. Push PC is a shortened form of writing which says take the value inside the register X, PC, which is X, copy that into the main memory at the point where the stack pointer is pointing to that address, to the address that's contained in the stack pointer, and decrement the stack pointer. And this whole thing is push hard-coded into the CPU. So similarly, it will push the, so the PC gets pushed, and then it will, if you go back to this code, it says push PC, push PS, load PC, load PS. So PC gets pushed, PS let's say is Y, then Y will get pushed, the stack pointer will decrement once again, and then we have to find the interrupt vector and which contains an address and interrupt vector which contains a value, and the address will be put into the PC and the value will be put into the program status. I'm going to ignore this value for the time being. So now the CPU was executing some instruction here between A and B. That's when the timer interrupt happened. So the timer interrupt did all this pushing and loading. At the end result is now the CPU program counter is pointing somewhere else, not within the scope of the program it was running. Okay? So diagrammatically what's happened is This is the setup. Program counter is in process P1, which is running program P1. Interrupt happens. This PC value gets, and this PC value is X. X gets pushed here. The PC value gets changed to this location because it loaded the interrupt vector. Now this handler contains some code, machine code, opcodes, that will get executed. And inside that handler is the job of the operating system's writer to put some magic in there, which will make the switch happen. So, when I come to the handler, I know that the program counter is already on the processor stack. I'm running this code. And I have set up some data structures called PCBs. And process P2 was running in the past. I'm making this assumption that P2 is not a brand new process. It was running in the past, and an interrupt caused it to go away. And now an interrupt is causing P1 to go away. So P2's configuration is exactly like P1's configuration now. And that's important because I'm going to pull old PCs out of a stack, which must have happened to P2 at some earlier point. There is a circular reference here. So stop me if it gets a little confusing at this point. So now I'm writing the interrupt handler. And this is the opcode in the interrupt handler. The push PC push program status wasn't there anywhere. That is hard-coded into the CPU. This is actual code written in the interrupt handler, but it's the same push. It pushes all the registers. So that means it pushes all the registers onto the stack. Of process one. Okay, this is a little tricky. I just asked the question, where is the PCB of process one? Here I have enough time and space to write a program to find process one's PCB. Because it is linked in to some linked list, chained up by some pointer, which is a global, so I'll have to go and get the address of the current processor's PCB. So I find this processor's PCB. So that's part of the code that's missing here. I'll write some code here which gets me an address to the process PCB of P1 and then computes where in the PCB of P1 is the field which should contain the stack pointer. And then it copies the stack pointer into the PCB of P1. Okay? I can write any code because while I'm executing this code, all the registers will get clobbered, but I don't care. I've already safely put away the registers using push instructions. Okay. Now, once this is done, I have actually managed to save the context, save all important information about process P1. Where is this important information? The stack pointer is in the PCB. All the registers are on the stack of the process P1. And the stack of the process P1 is in memory. As long as nothing overwrites that, we are safe. Everything has been stored. Yes.
So the stack pointer of the process is still in CPU, right?
It is still in CPU right now. So it's still running on the stack of P1, but I won't be using the stack pointer at this point. Okay? If I change the stack pointer now, in the CPU I have the stack pointer, but I have a copy on the PCB also.
So the source was the CPU.
Source was the CPU. This is the CPU register. All the R1, R2 are CPU registers. The PC and the PS are CPU registers. PC and the PS were automatically saved by the interrupt.
That was the hardware.
And I saved the rest of the registers. If there are more registers, I should save them too. Now, I will load into SP Okay, a PCB has lots of things. One of them is the stack pointer. So I stored the stack pointer of P1. Here, this stack pointer contains values from P1. I stored it into the PCB of P1. In the PCB of P2, there is a stack pointer. That stack pointer is the address of the stack of P2 exactly as it was when P2 was interrupted, which was in the past. We're not showing that. So we take the stack pointer field and load it onto the CPU stack pointer. Now I have changed the CPU stack pointer to something completely different. Okay? So I'm going to pop all the registers in reverse order. Well, that makes sense probably, because what has happened is there are two stacks. These two stacks, one belongs to P1, one belongs to P2. They're completely in different places in memory. Stack pointer of P1 should have been pointing over there. Stack pointer of P2 is pointing over there. But when I do this loading, now the CPU stack pointer is pointing here and no longer over there. Got it? Now when I pop R2, it will take the value of whatever the stack pointer pointing to and load it into the register 2. Okay, pop R2 means so these are very shortened words, which has a lot of meaning. I already talked about what push RX means. Take RX, put it where it should be on the stack. Pop RX means take whatever the topmost value on the stack and put it in RX. You're not popping RX, you're popping into RX. It's a little bit of an English problem here. Okay? So you're popping into Rx something from the stack. So the rest of the routine looks like pop R something, pop R2, pop R1. We've already copied SP to P2, and then return from interrupt. Return from interrupt is hard-coded to pop PS, pop PC. And now, this may be a little bit of a trickiness. Since I've already changed the stack and I do a return from interrupt, return from interrupt will pull the PC from the top of the stack and put it into the actual CPU PC. The PC that got pulled from top of the stack has an address which is in P2 when it was interrupted. And suddenly P2 starts running. All its registers has been restored, and this timer interrupt caused P1 to stop, P2 to start up. So it's just a few lines of code, a few lines of assembly code. The only part that I didn't write out is how do you find the SP in the PCB, but these are specific data structures in the kernel. Yeah?
So is like pop like a command that's normally used in assembly for this?
Yes, pop is an assembly opcode.
Oh.
All CPUs are supposed to have that. And it might have different names. Yeah?
So at this point, the SP still has the value for the second process.
Yes.
But when we started this whole routine, the SP had the value of the first
process. Right.
Current process has come.
Right. And now it has the value of the second process. The PC has the value of the second process. Everything has the values of the second process. So the second process starts running. This return from interrupt starts the second process. And it's not quite obvious from this code why does second process start running, but it does. Because you've just switched things around. Changing the SP is the miracle. You came in with some value of SP, you copied it out, copied a different value of SP, did a return, and it went somewhere else. Okay? So end result is, that if P1 was running and you got a timer interrupt, it is going to go to P2 and it's just going to go here and start executing here. And the context switch is that piece of code in the kernel whose address is stored in the interrupt vector. So you write your context switch routine, you store the address in the interrupt vector, and throw timer interrupts at it, it'll start switching processes. The only missing piece is how does it know whether you have to go to P2 or P3, so there has to be some way of telling the context switcher which process to go to. That part I didn't cover. And this is the mechanism. That's the exact piece of code in every operating system that switches processes around. There is a little more sugar coating on it. Any questions? Yeah.
So because the length of the interrupt vector, each tweet in interrupt vector is just half of the length of the entire memory location?
No, no. That's how I drew it. Each memory location is a certain length. If it's a word-oriented machine, is the word length 32 bits. If it's a 32-bit word-oriented machine, then your addresses should fit into 32 bits. So it'll be two words in memory. And one is the address field for the handler. One is the program status field. And that's it. Any other questions? So that's how context switching is done. It's done between 10 and 100 times a second on every single computer. And that's what it's doing. That's the ticks that's switching processes around from your cell phone to your laptop, everything. Yeah?
If you're taking if you assume process 2 to be a new process which has not been interrupted before, that case
things go a little weirder. But you have to build a brand new process. This is where it gets a little shady. You build a brand new process with its stack such that it looks like this process was interrupted at the first instruction it's supposed to execute. And then the OS goes, oh, it has been interrupted, let's go there. So when you're initializing a process, which is the loader's job, it builds processes that look like they've been interrupted already. And that's how you solve the problem. And now all processes are the same. They've all been interrupted, even though they have never run. And we can just switch things around. So there are lots of processes on the system. Each process has its own PCB. The PCBs have to be organized in some way by the operating system so that it can identify which PCB belongs to who. Each process, now if I have n processes, n minus one of them are not running. One is running, one CPU system. So n minus one processes, the top of the stack contains registers and the program counter. And its stack pointer value is in the PCB. In the running process, the top of the stack contains program data, not registers. We clear out that top of the stack before we run it. There's one process that's running. The context switch mechanism takes a running process, stops it, and starts up some other process. Coming to which process? So it takes this running process, stuffs its stack with the registers and program counter and all that, and puts it away in the sense that it just leaves it there. And then it picks up some other process, clears up its stack, and puts the piece, the pointer to the place it was supposed to run into the program counter, and that process starts running. Which process to start is a decision, it's a policy decision made by somebody called the scheduler, which we'll get to probably today. So there is something else called the scheduler which makes the decision that if you're going to stop this process, let me figure out which process to run. And that's inside the context switcher where it says, find the PCB of P2. That's when there's a call made to the scheduler, like where's the PCB of the next process? The scheduler says, okay, here's the chosen one, go do it. And that's all there is. So I'm going to the point is that I need to get more detailed and talk about the scheduler, which is actually a rather complicated thing. So before we do that, so what is a process? A process is a program which contains all the opcodes that were compiled from a C program or whatever language program. And that program has been put in an address space. By address space, I mean that A to B, certain memory locations where this program has been copied into. In that address space, there has to be some extra space added for the stack. It also has a PCB, and the PCB contains all the CPU registers, and this whole thing is called a process. And this thing executes on CPU sometimes. Because there's only one process executing on a single CPU system. If it's a dual CPU system, you just say there are two processes executing, but it's a very small number of processes. Sometimes, because there are lots more processes. And the fact that not everybody is executing at the same time is not really visible to any of the processes or to the human being. Because, let me see, I used to have a way of showing this. No, I lost it. What happened? I can't tell. So what's going on here? You can't see it, it doesn't matter. It's just a directory listing that's being printed over and over again in an infinite loop. And that's happening because there's a process running a particular program, right? Nothing to see here. But If we do this, we see that there are four of them running. And they're running at the same time. No, they're not. It just appears they're running at the same time. This illusion is being created because there's a scheduler and a context switcher who's just constantly switching around these processes. So yes, things run at the same time quite regularly on any machine. Yeah.
Since you can actually see this one looping, would it be possible if you had enough processes open to start seeing it slow down?
Yes, it would. It would start slowing down. It's a whole lot slower now. Because it's sharing the same thing. In fact, the video part is not coming in. Okay? Obvious question, but true. And we can fire up another 100, and it'll slow to a crawl at that point. Okay, now I'm going to sit and delete all these. Too many. So that's multiprocessing that happens on every operating system. So process is this thing. What's slightly confusing is that we often use the term thread. Thread is really a shortened version of thread of control. You must have heard of thread of control when you do programming. Your thread of control follows a sequential path through your program. It changes if you get to a if-then-else. Then it loops around if you get to a while. That's your thread of control. In a program, you have one thread of control. Not true. You can have multiple threads of control. But in general, we only do sequential programming where you have one thread of control. How do we have multiple threads of control? Let's say I wrote this following program. And I repeated that. And I start a thread. So the first time I start a thread, it is the same thing as a process. Let's say I have a method by which I can start a thread. That thread will print 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Right? That's what the program does. It will print 1, print 2, print 3, print 4. Why, just at the point where it has printed 1, if I could start another thread inside main, can I? Yes, I can. Then what's going to happen? So one particular execution of this green thread will print 1, 2, and let me just say, stop here. It'll print some other green numbers. At that point, somewhere after that, I start a red thread. The first number it's going to print will be? You don't know. Maybe 2. And if this red thread prints 2, the green thread might print 3 and might print 4. And then the red thread might print 5. It is that bizarre. And the green thread might also print 5, but we'll not talk about that yet. It's a race condition. But it happens also. So what's going on is this I is a global variable. There is only one copy of I. There are 2 threads executing this program doing the same thing and clobbering each other too. So the green thread printed 1. The red thread came in and incremented, started at the top, incremented I to 2, printed 2, and the green thread is somewhere here. It incremented 2 to 3 and printed 3. What if I said I have this very long program in an infinite loop and I'm going to throw 5 threads into that? It will be quite messy. But that's possible. Sometimes it's useful. So what is the difference? Right now I'm not going to start programming with multiple threads. We will do that. It's going to get nasty. But what is this thing called the thread? So thread is just like a process. It sequentially executes a program. Every thread and every process are sequential. Every process executes in a different address space. There's no sharing. They're completely separate things. Threads share address spaces, causing trouble. So what that means is this is process 1. It's got some data. It's got a program or code. This is process 2. It's got some data. This is got some program. And these two might be the same program, but it's separate. No, let's say these two are different programs. So this is program 1, program 2. There is always one thread in a process, which is the parent. And the terminology problem is that although process typically means everything, the data space, the program, the stack, the whatever, this first thread in a process is also called a process. The second thread in the process is called a thread. Or then we also say there are 2 threads. So there is a confusion in terminology. When I say process, does it mean the first thread of the process or the whole thing? It means both. When I say thread, it means there is one of the threads of the process, and there may be more than one thread in a process. And if there are multiple threads in process P1, they will all execute at the same time. Again, nothing executes at the same time, but they'll appear to execute at the same time, and there'll be multiple threads in each processes. Threads I said parent process, so what's the difference between parent process and parent thread? I don't know. It's just bad terminology. The parent process is also the parent thread. And the parent process owns the real estate, the address space. Okay? And in the parent process, there's at least one thread. You can call it the parent thread. If there are more threads, then the parent thread created these threads. They're children threads. They're siblings. A child thread can create a grandchild thread. Let's not go to that part. And so there are several threads running in a process. Now, what I'm trying to get at is that these things all share the global data and heap and code, which is the program, but do not share stack and PCB. So let's say we have three threads in a process. The process has the global data area, it has a heap, which is where the allocated memory is. The process has a stack, the stack's private. None of the children can see the parent stack. And none of the children can see each other's stack either. They do not share the stack. That's so that they don't clobber over each other's call and return function, things like that. They do not share PCBs. So do threads have PCBs? Yes, they do. Every thread has its own PCB. We should really call them TCBs, thread control blocks. But so what's a PCB, what's a TCB? Same thing. Every activity has a PCB or TCB. And to make it worse, a lot of people, including me, confuse the terminologies and call processes threads and call threads processes. So be careful when I talk about processes. I often mean a thread. Yeah.
So do you like switch between threads?
You switch between threads just like you switch between processes. There's virtually no difference between a thread and a process except that groups of threads share the same addresses. And that address container is the process, along with its main thread. So it's just bad terminology, that's all. Because the concept of a process came first, and then somebody goes, hey, we can have threads also. Yeah.
So what does something like Intel hyper-threading do?
Completely different story. Completely nothing to do with this. Hyper-threading is a kludge way of creating two CPUs out of one. So it's a hyper-threaded CPU is a CPU that declares to the software, including the operating system, I'm two CPUs, I'm not one CPU.
Okay, so
from the OS point of view, it's got two CPUs. And from the hardware point of view, there's some cheating going on there. Okay. So it has two program counters. That's essentially what an hyper-threaded processor does. Yeah.
So the PCB and the stack of a process is within its own memory.
No. A stack is within its own memory. But the PCB is in the kernel memory. So the PCB is completely hidden stuff that, as an application programmer, you will never see PCBs. They don't exist. As an application programmer, you'll never see context switching. They don't exist. It's that nasty thing called the operating system stealing the CPU away from you and giving it back to you without you knowing and without you having any control over when that context switching is going to happen. And that's where we say the OS has more power. It doles out the CPU in little bursts to various threads or processes, and that decision as to when it's going to do that, who's more equal than who, is decided by the scheduler.
So, if all the threads share the global database, but they have their own PCB.
They have their own PCB.
So if a thread changes the global data, does...
All threads see the change. Oh, no. Don't confuse data and the PCB. Okay. This is global data. Huh? So is this global data. It's in memory, and this is the boundaries of the process A and B, C and D. The PCBs are stored somewhere else. This is PCB of... Why did I draw two PCBs there? Because there are two threads in there, so it needs two PCBs. When a thread changes some data, nothing happens here. This is just a scratchpad thing for the operating system to play games with. Okay? So this is never touched by the processes. Operating systems keep, you know, values of their registers and stuff in the PCBs, used for context switching. There are as many PCBs as there are threads. There are two threads in this process, so there are two PCBs. They should be called TCBs. And the data is completely shared, so if one of them makes any change, it changes. The other process sees the change. The other thread sees the change. And these two are complete, this guy and this guy is completely separate. If this guy makes changes to his global data, that global data is not visible from this program. They're different programs. And the reason, and this guy cannot change anything there because of the memory bounds, the base and bound registers. So you can ask, where is the stack? Yeah.
Yeah, so if the stack is handled by the process, and the process makes changes to the stack, will that not lead to problems with context switching?
No, it won't. Now, so firstly, where is the stack? How many stacks are there in this situation?
There are two of them. Each process has its own stack.
There's more than that.
Four of each.
There's four of them. I've assumed there are two threads per process. So there's four stacks. Where are the stacks? So this guy has two stacks. I should use the same color. So this guy has a stack, this guy has a stack, this guy has a PCB, and this guy has a PCB. Okay, so let's say we have the orange PCB and the purple PCB and the orange stack and the purple stack. Now these two stacks belong to the same process and it's in their address space. So technically it can, the orange thread can clobber the purple stack, but we're going to assume they're well behaved, they don't do that. But it's possible to do that. Now your question was, the context switcher is also using the stack. Won't they mess things up? See, if the orange thread is running and the stack is getting updated, so it's growing and shrinking, timer interrupt happens, the stack freezes at that point, the context switcher adds some stuff to the stack and switches to another thread. Now, orange thread is not running, so it doesn't even know its stack has been messed with. When the orange thread starts running, its stack has been cleared out and it doesn't see anything. So it's very surreptitious of the context switcher to use a thread stack to store information about the thread, which the thread will never see. Okay? So whenever there's corruption, the thread's not running. When the thread's running, it's its own stack. So every thread has its own stack. Every process has its own data, code, and contains these threads. And I'm going to just go ahead and assume we only work with single CPU systems, so only one of these threads are running. The other ones have data, their contexts stored in their respective PCBs. The thread that is running has out-of-date data in the PCB, because that's the old registers. But when it's stopped, they'll get updated. Questions? Okay, a process is the thing that runs, is the same thing as a thread. A process has states. That means that each thread has states too. Each thread is a process. A process is a thread. The process states this is how we draw a process state diagram. And this is one particular process or thread. Every process or thread starts up in the new state. New means this is getting, the operating system is creating it. It takes time for an operating system to allocate the PCBs, copy the stuff over from disk, allocate memory space. So while the process is being created, other processes are running. We say this process is in the new state. From the new state, at some point when all bookwork has been done, the operating system changes the state of a process. So there is a field in the PCB which says what's the state of this process. It changes it to a ready state. Ready state is the state where most processes stay most of the time. That is, if the scheduler gave it a CPU, it could run, but right now there's no CPU available for it. It's just waiting. So there's a difference between ready and waiting. Ready is it's waiting for a CPU. And if the CPU becomes available, it goes into the running state. There is only one process in the running state in a single CPU system. That process keeps running. That process keeps running how long? One of two things happen. Either it gets switched out due to a timer interrupt where it goes back to the ready state, or it does something like IO, error condition, IO generally. I want to read a file. I want to print something on the screen. Those things take time. So at that point, the scheduler will say, we are not going to keep you on the CPU. We are going to put you into the waiting state. You made a request to write to a disk or write to the screen. Some kernel routine will take care of it. We'll later bring you back. So that's in the waiting state. This is waiting for I/O. And there could be many processes in that state. There could be many processes in that state. There is only one in single CPU. And there'll be only two running if it's a multi-CPU. And exiting is when the process has dropped off the end of the program. There's nothing to do anymore. But it's still kept around. Sometimes they're called zombies, because the operating system has to clean up. So while the cleanup activity is going on, the process will be in the exiting state, which will last for a very short time. Then the process will be gone forever. And that's the state diagram of a process. In fact, there is always one process running in any system. The number of processes that are ready on a laptop computer is very few. There's nothing going on here. I'm not touching it. There's no activity going on this right now. But there is always one process running because the CPU never stops. You've got to give it something to do. It's on this fetch and execute loop. So every operating system creates a dummy process which does nothing, just sits in an infinite loop, maybe calculates the powers of pi or something, and calls it the system idle process. And right now, system idle process is running 99% of the CPU. Okay? Whereas if I start doing something, the system idle process will start decreasing in the amount of time it gets because I am playing with something. But if I don't do anything, it will go up to 99. So, that's what's the overall picture of what goes on in an operating system. The scheduling queues are queues of PCBs. You see, I kept saying the PCBs are stored somewhere. A PCB is typically has it doesn't have PCPS, but it has stack pointer, registers, plus owner, and lots of info. That's the typical structure of a PCB. It has all this information, so it's a struct. And in this struct, there are all these fields, stack pointer, register this, whatever, stuff. And in addition, there is a previous pointer and a next pointer, which allows PCBs to be chained up. PCBs are chained up, put in a queue, and various pointers point to groups of PCB in each queue in the kernel memory of the operating system, and that's how we can find PCBs by traversing those queues. So how many queues are there, and what's the scheduling queues about? The operating system has global pointers with names like new process, ready queue, running, etc. Those are counters. And they're pointers to PCBs. This is the scheduling queues. The important one is the ready queue. Ready queue contains processes that are ready to run. It's a queue. It may or may not. Now, when we say queue, in the strictest data structures terminology, it's a first-in, first-out structure. Operating systems cheat. They don't implement queues as first-in, first-out. They just throw things in a queue and somehow reorder them sometimes. So it's loosely first-in, first-out, although we use the word queue. So the ready queue is may or may not be first-in, first-out structure or processes waiting to be served. The run queue will have only one process in it, or PCB in it, rather, because that's the one that's running. The waiting queue will have lots of things lined up in a queue, but they may be satisfied in, not in first-in, first-out order, whoever gets its input first. For some other reason, we'll get out of there. New processes get thrown in this queue, and then they get moved over to ready queue. Ready processes moved over to run queue. Running processes can go to wait queue, or back to ready queue, or they exit. And there's one more thing here. Waiting can go to ready. This diagram looks uncannily similar to the process state diagram. Same labels, same structure, but they're not the same. That's the previous slide was a slide of one process being in various states. This is the global picture of many processes located at different locations in the scheduling queues in the operating system. There is a piece of software in the operating system called a CPU scheduler. It handles state transitions of certain processes based on a bunch of rules that controls which process in the ready queue should go to the run queue. If it was really a queue, it would be first in, first out, the first process. First in, first out scheduler will be called first in, first out scheduler. But most schedulers are not first in, first out. So scheduler is a box that makes decisions as to all these waiting processes, which one should come here. And it's an important decision. It also makes the decision of when to stop a process and throw it out in here. I made it sound like it's done on every timer interrupt automatically. Actually, no. Schedulers tell reprogram the timer interrupts not to switch on every timer based on how important that process is. Some processes can be switched on every timer interrupt. Some processes are never switched on every time interrupt. Some processes theoretically can never be switched out. But, so that's a scheduling decision that we'll talk about later. And so this line goes back. A process that goes into the wait queue, scheduler has nothing to do with it. This thing happens because the process did something. I want I.O., made a request. This has got nothing to do with the scheduler either. This is something that happens when input is ready due to the disk drive providing some service or whatever, or a network packet arriving, or a user typing something. So next focus will be just these two transitions. And we'll spend a lot of time talking about these two transitions. They're that important.